This is Audible.
Bantam Audio Publishing presents a Turner Bantam Audio production of Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, winner of the Turner Tomorrow Fellowship. The first time I read the ad, I choked and cursed and spat and threw the paper to the floor. Since even this wasn't enough, I snatched it up, marched into the kitchen, and shoved it into the trash. While I was there, I made myself a little breakfast and gave myself some time to cool down. I ate and thought about something else entirely. That's right. Then I dug the paper out of the trash and turned back to the personal section, just to see if the damn thing was still there. It was. Teacher seeks pupil. Must have an earnest desire to save the world. Apply in person. An earnest desire to save the world. Oh, I like that. An earnest desire to save the world. Yeah, that was splendid. You will doubtless wonder, why is this man so indignant, so bitter? That's a fair question. The answer goes back to a time a couple of decades ago, when I'd had the silly notion that the thing I most needed in the world was a teacher. That's right. I imagined I needed a teacher to show me how one goes about doing something that might be called saving the world. It came about in this way. During the children's revolt of the 60s and 70s, I was just old enough to understand what these kids had in mind, and just young enough to believe that they might actually succeed. It's true. Every morning when I opened my eyes, I expected to see that the new era had begun, that the sky was a brighter blue and the grass a brighter green. I expected to hear laughter in the air and to see people dancing in the streets. Not just kids. Everyone. Then one day, when I was in my mid-teens, I woke up and saw that the revolt had dwindled away into a fashion statement. I was disillusioned and bewildered, and in my innocence, I thought there must be someone out there who could set me straight, a teacher, so I looked for one. Silly as it sounds now, that's what I did. I looked until I wised up and stopped making a fool of myself. And now, years after I'd given up the search, here was some charlatan advertising in the paper for the very same young dreamer I'd been 15 years ago. I know this doesn't really explain my outrage. Let it go. I was being irrational. It happens. It's allowed. I had to go, of course. Had to satisfy myself that it was just another scam. 30 seconds would do it. A single look. 10 words out of his mouth. Then I would go home and forget about it. When I got there, I was surprised to find it was a very ordinary sort of office building. I'd expected something a little more atmospheric. Brownstone with paneled walls, high ceilings, and shuttered windows, perhaps. I was looking for room 105, and I found it in the back, where a window would overlook the alley. The door was uninformative. I pushed it open and stepped into a large, empty room. That was my first impression, emptiness. The second was olfactory. The place reeked of the circus. No, not the circus, the menagerie. Unmistakable, but not unpleasant. I looked around. Against the wall at the left stood a small bookcase containing 30 or 40 volumes, mainly on history, prehistory, and anthropology. A lone, overstuffed chair stood in the middle, facing the wall at the right. There was something odd about the room, but it took me another look round to figure out what it was. In the wall opposite the door stood two tall windows admitting a feeble light from the alley. The wall to the left was blank. The wall to the right was pierced by a large plate glass window, but this was plainly not a window to the outside world, for it admitted no light at all. It was a window into an adjacent room. Because it was backed by darkness, the glass in this window was black, opaque, reflective. I made no attempt to see beyond it. As I approached, I was the spectacle under observation. On arrival, I continued to gaze into my own eyes for a moment, then rolled the focus forward beyond the glass, and found myself looking into another pair of eyes. I fell back, startled. And then, recognizing what I'd seen, I fell back again, now a little frightened. The creature on the other side of the glass was a full-grown gorilla. Full-grown says nothing, of course. He was terrifyingly enormous. A boulder, a sarsen of Stonehenge. His sheer mass was alarming in itself, even though he wasn't using it in any menacing way. On the contrary, he was half sitting, half reclining, most placidly nibbling delicately on a slender branch he carried in his left hand like a wand. I didn't know what to say. You can judge my confusion by this fact, that it seemed to me I should speak, excuse myself, explain my presence, justify my intrusion, beg the creature's pardon. I felt it was an affront to gaze into his eyes, but I was paralyzed, helpless. I could look at nothing else in the world but his face, more hideous than any other in the animal kingdom because of its similarity to our own, yet in its way more noble than any Greek ideal of perfection. As my fear began to ebb, I said to myself that there was nothing to keep me there, that I should go home. But I didn't like to leave without accomplishing anything at all. I looked around thinking I'd leave a note if I could find something to write on, but there was nothing. Nevertheless, this search brought to my attention something I'd overlooked in the room that lay beyond the glass. It was a sign or poster hanging on the wall behind the gorilla. It read, "With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla?" This text stopped me. Words are my profession. I seized these and demanded that they explain themselves, that they cease to be ambiguous. Did they imply that hope for gorillas lay in the extinction of mankind, or in mankind's survival? With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla? It was, of course, a con, meant to be inexplicable. It disgusted me, because the magnificent creature beyond the glass was evidently there just to serve as a sort of illustration for this con. You really ought to do something about this, I told myself angrily. And then I added, it would be best if you sat down and were still. I listened to the echo of this strange admonishment as if it were a fragment of music I couldn't quite identify. I looked at the chair and wondered, would it be best to sit down and be still? And if so, why? The answer came readily enough, because if you are still, then you will be better able to hear. Yes, I thought, that is undeniably so. For no conscious reason, I lifted my eyes to those of my beastly companion. As everyone knows, eyes speak. A pair of strangers can reveal their mutual attraction in a glance. His eyes spoke, and I understood. My legs turned to jelly, and I barely managed to reach the chair without collapsing. But how? I said, not daring to speak the words aloud. What does it matter? He replied as silently. It's so, and nothing more needs to be said. But you, I sputtered, you are... I found that having come to the word, I could not speak it. He nodded, acknowledging my difficulty. I am the teacher. We gazed into each other's eyes, and my head felt as empty as a derelict barn. And then he said, "Do you need time to collect yourself?" "Yes," I cried, speaking aloud for the first time. "Will it help you to listen to my story?" "Indeed it will," I said. "But first, if you will, please tell me your name." He stared at me for a while without replying and without expression. Then he proceeded as if I hadn't spoken at all. "I was born somewhere in the forests of equatorial West Africa," he said. "Do you happen to know the methods of Frank and Osa Johnson?" I looked up, startled. I've never even heard of them. They were famous animal collectors of the 30s. Their method with gorillas was this. On finding a band, they would shoot the females and pick up all the infants in sight. "How terrible," I said, without thinking. The creature replied with a shrug. I have no actual memory of the event, though I have memories of earlier times. In any case, the Johnsons sold me to a zoo in a small northeastern city, where I lived for several years. He paused and nibbled absent-mindedly on his branch for a while, as if gathering his thoughts. In such places, he went on at last, where animals are simply penned up, they are almost always more thoughtful than their cousins in the wild. This is because even the dimmest of them cannot help but sense that something is very wrong with this style of living. I don't mean that they acquire powers of ratiocination, but the tiger you see madly pacing its cage is nevertheless preoccupied with something a human would certainly recognize as a thought. And this thought is a question. Why? Why the tiger asks itself, hour after hour, day after day, year after year, as it treads its endless path behind the bars of its cage. It cannot analyze the question or elaborate on it. If you were somehow able to ask this creature, why what, it would be unable to answer you. Before long, I too began to ask myself why. Being neurologically far ahead of the tiger, I was able to examine what I meant by this, at least in a rudimentary way. I remembered a different life that was interesting and pleasant. By contrast, this life was boring and never pleasant. Thus, in asking why, I was wondering why life should be divided in this way, half of it interesting and pleasant, and half of it boring and unpleasant. In this way, my interior life began, quite unnoticed. Although I knew nothing of it, the Great Depression was taking its toll on all aspects of American life. Zoos everywhere were cutting back. To make a long story short, I was sold to the owner of a traveling menagerie with an empty wagon to fill. You might imagine that life in one cage is like life in any other cage, but this isn't so. At the zoo, the public was kept well away from us. At the menagerie, I was in contact with the public from the first moment. A small group of visitors approached my wagon and immediately began speaking to me. I was astounded. At the zoo, visitors had talked to one another, never to us. I simply didn't know what to make of it. The next day, paying more attention to what they were saying, I noticed that when visitors came to the wagon beside mine, occupied by a female chimpanzee, they cried out, "Zha zha, zha zha, zha zha." But when they came to my wagon, they called out, "Goliath, Goliath, Goliath." By small steps, I soon understood that these sounds, in some mysterious way, attached directly to the two of us as individuals. You who have had a name from birth can hardly imagine what a revolution this produced in me. It would be no exaggeration to say that I was truly born in that moment, born as a person. From the realization that I had a name to the realization that everything has a name was not a great leap. You might think a caged animal has little opportunity to learn a language, but this isn't so. Menageries attract families, and parents are incessantly schooling their children in the arts of language. "Look, Johnny, there's a duck. Can you say duck? Duck? Do you know what a duck says? A duck says quack, quack." I only had to listen in order to learn. Several years passed in this way. Then, one rainy day, when the lot was deserted, I received a peculiar visitor, a lone man who looked to me ancient and shriveled. Even his approach was distinctive. He stood at the menagerie entrance, glanced methodically at each wagon in turn, then headed straight for mine. He paused at the rope, planted the tip of his walking stick in the mud, and peered intently into my eyes. I've never been disconcerted by a human gaze, so I placidly returned his stare. Several minutes passed. I remember feeling admiration for this man, so stoically enduring the drizzle that was streaming down his face and soaking his clothes. At last he straightened up and gave me a nod, as if he'd come to some carefully considered conclusion. "You are not Goliath," he said. With that he turned and marched back the way he'd come. I was thunderstruck. Not Goliath? What could it possibly mean to be not Goliath? It didn't occur to me to say, "Well, if I'm not Goliath, who am I?" A human would ask this question because he would know that whatever his name, he is assuredly someone. I did not. On the contrary, it seemed to me that if I wasn't Goliath, then I must be no one at all. As I felt it, my awareness of selfhood had been pronounced a delusion. I drifted into a sort of fugue state, neither aware nor unconscious. An attendant came round with food, but I ignored him. Night fell, but I didn't sleep. The rain stopped and the sun rose without my noticing. Soon the crowds came, calling out, "Goliath, Goliath," but I paid no attention. Several days passed in this way. Then one evening I took a long drink from my bowl and fell asleep. A powerful sedative had been added to my water. At dawn, I awoke in an unfamiliar cage. At first, because it was so large and strangely shaped, I didn't even recognize it as a cage. It was circular and open to the air on all sides. As I later understood, a gazebo had been modified to serve the purpose. Except for a large white house nearby, it stood alone in an attractive park I imagined must extend to the ends of the earth. I was still exploring my new home when, around mid-morning, I looked up and saw that I was not alone. A man was standing just beyond the bars, blackly silhouetted against the sunlit house in the distance. I approached cautiously and was astonished to recognize him. As if reenacting our former encounter, we gazed into each other's eyes. I saw that, dry and freshly dressed, he was not the elderly person I'd taken him for. His face was long, dark, and bony. His eyes burned with a strange intensity, and his mouth seemed set in an expression of bitter mirth. At last he nodded, exactly as before, and said, "Yes, I was right. You are not Goliath. You are Ishmael." Once again, as if everything was now finally settled, he turned and walked away. And once again I was thunderstruck, but this time by a feeling of profound relief, for I'd been redeemed from oblivion and made whole again. My benefactor was a wealthy Jewish merchant of this city, a man by the name of Walter Sokolov. On the day he discovered me at the menagerie, he'd been out walking in a kind of suicidal gloom that had descended on him a few months before, when he learned that his entire family had been swallowed up in the Nazi Holocaust. His wanderings led him to a carnival set up at the edge of town, and he went in without thinking. Because of the rain, most of the booths and rides were shut down, giving the place an air of abandonment that accorded well with his melancholy. At last he came to the menagerie, whose chief attractions were advertised in a series of lurid paintings. One of these, more lurid than the rest, depicted the gorilla Goliath, brandishing the broken body of an African native as if it were a weapon. Perhaps thinking that a gorilla named Goliath was an apt symbol for the Nazi giant that was then engaged in crushing the race of David, Walter Sokolov decided it would be satisfying to behold such a monster behind bars. He went in, approached my wagon, and by gazing into my eyes soon saw I was no relation to the bloodthirsty monster in the painting, and indeed no relation to the Philistine tormentor of his race. He found it gave him no satisfaction to see me behind bars. On the contrary, in a quixotic gesture of guilt and defiance, he decided to rescue me from my cage and fashion me into a dreadful substitute for the family he had failed to rescue from the cage of Europe. The owner of the menagerie was agreeable to a sale. After letting me settle in for a day in my new surroundings, Mr. Sokolov again visited the gazebo, and we gazed at each other in a long silence as before. Finally, reluctantly, as if surmounting some daunting interior barrier, he began to speak to me, not in the jocular way of visitors to the menagerie, but rather as one speaks to the wind or the waves, uttering that which must be said, but which must not be heard by anyone. As he poured out his sorrows and self-recriminations, he gradually forgot the need for caution. After an hour, he was propped up against my cage with a hand wrapped around a bar. He was looking at the ground, lost in thought, and I used this opportunity to express my sympathy, reaching out and gently stroking the knuckles of his hand. He leapt back, startled and horrified, but a search of my eyes reassured him that my gesture was innocent of menace. Alerted by this experience, he began to suspect that I possessed real intelligence, and a few simple tests convinced him of this. Satisfied that I understood his words, he leapt to the conclusion that I should be able to produce some of my own, and decided to teach me to talk. I'll pass over the painful months that followed. Neither of us understood that the difficulty was insurmountable, owing to a lack of basic phonic equipment on my part. But at last a day came when I couldn't go on, and in my anguish at not being able to tell him this, I thought him this, with all the mental power I possessed. He was stunned, as was I when I saw that he'd heard my mental cry. I won't burden you with all the steps of our progress once full communication was established between us. They're easily imagined. Over the next decade, he taught me all he knew of the world, the universe, and human history. And when my questions went beyond his knowledge, we studied side by side. And when my studies carried me beyond his own interests, at last, he cheerfully became a sort of research assistant to me. By the early 60s, I was like a house guest who needed very little attention from his host. So Mr. Sokolov began to be seen again in society. Soon he was engaged to be married. The prospect of marriage pleased him, but he made a terrible mistake in anticipation of it. He decided our special relationship would be kept secret from his wife. It wasn't an extraordinary decision for those times, and I wasn't sufficiently experienced in such matters to recognize it for the error it was. I moved back to the gazebo, but from the first, Mrs. Sokolov viewed me as a peculiar and alarming pet, and began agitating for my removal. Luckily, my benefactor was used to having his own way and made it clear that my situation was unalterable. A few months later, he dropped in to tell me that his wife, like Abraham's Sarah, was soon going to present him with a child of his old age. "I anticipated nothing like this when I named you Ishmael," he told me. "But rest assured, I won't let her cast you out of my house the way Sarah cast your namesake out of Abraham's house." Nevertheless, it amused him to say that if it was a boy, he would name him Isaac. As matters turned out, however, it was a girl, and they named her Rachel. Wisely or foolishly, my benefactor decided I would be the girl's mentor, and wisely or foolishly, I was delighted to please him in this way. In her father's arms, Rachel spent nearly as much time with me as with her mother, which of course did nothing to improve my standing with that person. Because I was able to speak to her in a language more direct than speech, I could soothe and amuse her when others failed, and a bond gradually developed between us that might be likened to the one that exists between identical twins. Mrs. Sokolov looked forward to the day when Rachel would begin school, for then new interest would make her a stranger to me. When this didn't happen, she renewed her campaign to have me sent away, predicting that my presence would stunt the child's social growth. Her social growth remained unstunted, however, even though she skipped no fewer than 3 grades in elementary school and 1 grade in high school. She had a master's degree in biology before her 20th birthday. On the death of my benefactor in 1985, Rachel herself became my protector. There was no question of my remaining in the gazebo. Using funds provided for this purpose in her father's will, Rachel moved me to a retreat prepared in advance. In the years that followed, however, I found I was not content to retreat. I wanted somehow to advance into the very center of your culture, and I proceeded to exhaust my new protector's patience by trying one bothersome arrangement after another to achieve this end. It was not until 1989 that things came clear at last. I finally comprehended that my vocation was to teach, and finally devised a system that would enable me to exist in tolerable circumstances in this city. He nodded to let me know that this was the end of his story, or as much of it as he meant to tell. There are times when having too much to say can be as dumbfounding as having too little. I could think of no way to respond gracefully to such a tale, so finally I asked a question. "And have you had many pupils?"
"I have had 4, and failed with all 4.
"Oh, why'd you fail?" He closed his eyes to think for a moment.
"I failed because I underestimated the difficulty of what I was trying to teach, and because I didn't understand my pupils' minds well enough."
"I see," I said. "And what do you teach?" Ishmael selected a fresh branch from the pile at his right, examined it briefly, and then began to nibble at it, gazing languidly into my eyes. At last he said, "On the basis of my history, what would you say I was best qualified to teach?"
I told him I didn't know.
"Of course you do. My subject is captivity."
"Captivity?"
"That's correct." I sat there for a minute. Then I said, I'm trying to figure out what this has to do with saving the world."
Ishmael thought for a moment. "Among the people of your culture, which want to destroy the world.
Which want to destroy? No one specifically wants to destroy the world.
And yet you do destroy it, each of you. Each of you contributes daily to the destruction of the world.
Yes, that's so.
Why don't you stop?
I shrugged. Frankly, we don't know how.
You're captives of a civilizational system that compels you to go on destroying the world in order to live.
Yes, that's true.
Oddly enough, Ishmael said, it was my benefactor who awakened my interest in the subject of captivity, and not my own condition. As I indicated, he was obsessed by what was then happening in Nazi Germany.
Yes, that's what I gathered.
Are you by any chance a student of the German people under Adolf Hitler?
A student? No. I've read about it some.
In that case, perhaps you already know what Mr. Sokolov was at pains to show me, that it wasn't only the Jews who were captives under Hitler. The entire German nation was a captive, including his enthusiastic supporters. Some detested what he was doing, some just shambled on as best they could, and some positively thrived on it, but they were all captives.
I see what you mean.
What was it that held them captive?
Well, I suppose it was Hitler's charisma.
Charisma certainly wins people's attention, but after that you have to have something to say. What did Hitler have to tell the German people?
I pondered this for a few moments without any real conviction. Apart from the Jewish business, I'm not sure.
What he had to tell them was a story.
A story?
A story in which the Aryan race, and the people of Germany in particular, had been deprived of their rightful place in the world, bound, spat upon, raped, and ground into the dirt under the heels of mongrel races, communists, and Jews. A story in which, under the leadership of Adolf Hitler, the Aryan race would burst its bonds, wreak vengeance on its oppressors, purify mankind of its defilements, and assume its rightful place as the master of all races.
True, I said.
After nearly two decades of degradation and suffering following World War I, this story had an overwhelming appeal, and it was reinforced by propaganda and an intensive program of education of the young and re-education of the old.
True.
Many recognized it as a grotesque fantasy, but they were nevertheless held captive by it, because the masses around them thought it sounded wonderful, and were willing to give their lives to make it a reality. Whatever you thought, you had to play your part, you had to take your place in the story. The only alternative was to escape from Germany entirely.
True.
Do you understand why I'm telling you this?
I'm not sure.
I'm telling you this because the people of your culture are in the same situation. Like the people of Nazi Germany, they are the captives of a story.
I sat there blinking for a while.
I know of no such story, I told him at last.
You mean you've never heard of it?
That's right.
Ishmael nodded.
That's because there's no need to hear of it. There's no need to name it or discuss it. Every one of you knows it by heart by the time you're six or seven. Black and white, male and female, rich and poor, Christian and Jew, American and Russian, Norwegian and Chinese, you all hear it. And you hear it incessantly. Because every medium of propaganda, every medium of education pours it out incessantly. And hearing it incessantly, you don't listen to it. There's no need to listen to it. It's always there, humming away in the background. So there's no need to attend to it at all. In fact, you'll find it's hard to attend to it. But once you know this story, you'll hear it everywhere, and you'll be astonished that those around you don't hear it as well, but merely take it in. A German who couldn't bring himself to take a place in Hitler's story had an option. He could leave Germany. Germany, after all, was the only place where that story was being enacted. Things are not so easy for you. If you don't like the story that's being enacted in your culture, you're out of luck. Because anywhere you go in the world, you'll find the same story being enacted. For you, there is no escape.
Yes, that's true.
Mother culture teaches you that this is as it should be. Except for a few savages scattered here and there, all the peoples of the earth are now enacting this story. This is the story man was born to enact. And to depart from it is to resign from the human race itself, is to venture into oblivion. Your place is here, participating in this story, putting your shoulder to the wheel, and as a reward, being allowed to live. To step out of this story is to fall off the edge of the world. There's no way out of it except through death. Yes, that's the way it seems. Abruptly, as if we'd reached some expected destination, Ishmael held up a leathery black hand and told me, "Tomorrow." Nights when I wake up at 2 o'clock, and that's it for sleep. And that night was one of them. The time passed, dawn came, I showered, ate breakfast, drove downtown. The building was still there, the office at the end of the hall was still there. When I opened the door, Ishmael's huge, meaty aroma came down on me like a thunderclap. On wobbly legs, I walked to the chair and sat down. My gorilla teacher studied me gravely through the dark glass, as if wondering if I was strong enough to be taxed with serious conversation. When he made up his mind, he began without preamble of any kind, and I came to know that this was his usual style. "It is my most heartfelt fantasy to travel just once in your world as you do, freely and unobtrusively, to step out onto a street and take a taxi to the airport, where I would board a flight to New York or London or Florence. Much of this fantasy is spent in making delicious preparations for the journey, in pondering what must accompany me in my luggage and what may be safely left behind. You understand that I would be traveling in human disguise. If I take too much, it will be a burden. On the other hand, if I take too little, I will forever be having to break my journey to pick up things along the way, and that will be even more tiresome." "True," I said, just to be agreeable. "That's what today is for. We're packing a bag for our journey together. I'm going to throw into this bag some things I won't want to stop and pick up later on. These things will mean little or nothing to you right now. I'll just show them to you briefly and toss them into the bag. That way you'll recognize them when I take them out later on." "Okay." "First, some vocabulary. Let's have some names, so we don't have to go on talking about the people of your culture and the people of all other cultures. I'm going to try a new pair of names with you. You're familiar with the expression, take it or leave it. Do the words takers and leavers used in this sense have any heavy connotation for you? I mean, if I call one group takers and the other group leavers, will this sound like I'm setting up one to be the good guys and the other to be the bad guys?" "Well, they sound pretty neutral to me." "Good. So henceforth, I'm going to call the people of your culture takers and the people of all other cultures leavers." I hummed a bit. I have a problem with that."
"Speak."
"I don't see how you can lump everyone else in the world into one category like that." "This is how it's done in your own culture, except that you use a pair of heavily loaded terms instead of these relatively neutral terms. You call yourselves civilized, and all others primitive. You're universally agreed on these terms. People in London and Paris and Baghdad and Seoul all know that whatever else separates them, they are united in being civilized and distinct from Stone Age people scattered all over the world. You recognize that whatever their differences, these Stone Age peoples are likewise united in being primitive." "Yes, that's right," I said. "The point is made. Takers and leavers is fine with me." Ishmael went on. "Second, the map. I have it. You don't have to memorize the route. In other words, don't worry if at the end of any day you suddenly realize you can't remember a word I've said. That doesn't matter. It's the journey itself that's going to change you. Do you see what I mean?" "I'm not sure." Ishmael thought for a moment. "I'll give you a general idea of where we're heading, then you'll understand." Okay. Mother culture, whose voice has been in your ear since the day of your birth, has given you an explanation of how things came to be this way. You know it well. Everyone in your culture knows it well. But this explanation wasn't given to you all at once. No one ever sat you down and said, here is how things came to be this way, beginning 10 or 15 billion years ago, right up to the present. Rather, you assembled it like a mosaic from a million bits of information presented to you in all sorts of ways. You assembled it from your parents' table talk, from cartoons on television, from Sunday school lessons, from textbooks and teachers, from news broadcasts, movies, novels, sermons, plays, newspapers, and all the rest. Are you with me so far? I think so. This explanation of how things came to be this way is ambient in your culture. Everyone knows it, and everyone accepts it without question. Okay? As we make our journey here, we're going to be re-examining key pieces of that mosaic. We're going to be taking them out of your mosaic and fitting them into an entirely different mosaic, into an entirely different explanation of how things came to be this way. And when we're finished, you'll have an entirely new perception of the world and of all that's happened here. And you don't have to remember how that perception was assembled. The journey itself is going to change you. Right, I see what you mean now. Third, he said, definitions. These are words that will have a special meaning in our discourse here. First, story. A story is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay. Second, to enact. To enact a story is to live so as to make the story a reality. In other words, to enact a story is to strive to make it come true. Okay. Third, culture. A culture is a people enacting a story. People enacting a story. And a story, again, is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay, so you're saying that the people of my culture are enacting their own story about man, the world, and the gods. Exactly. But I still don't know what that story is. You will. For the moment, all you have to know is that two fundamentally different stories have been enacted here during the lifetime of man. One began to be enacted here about 3 million years ago by those we've agreed to call levers, and is still being enacted by them today as successfully as ever. The other began to be enacted here some 10,000 years ago by those we've agreed to call takers, and is apparently about to end in catastrophe. Ah, I said, meaning I know not what. If mother culture were to explain human history in these terms, it would sound something like this. The levers were chapter one of human history, a long and uneventful chapter. Their chapter ended some 10,000 years ago with the birth of agriculture in the Near East. This birth opened chapter two of human history, the chapter of the takers. It's true there are still levers in the world, but these are anachronisms, fossils, people living in the past, people who just don't realize that their chapter of human history is over. Right. This is the general shape of human history as it's perceived in your culture. I would say so. As you'll come to see, what I'm saying is quite different from this. The levers are not chapter one of a story in which the takers are chapter two. The levers and the takers are enacting two separate stories based on entirely different and contradictory premises. Ishmael scratched the side of his jaw thoughtfully. I think our bag is packed. As I said, I don't expect you to remember everything I've thrown into it today, but that's all right. If I pull out something tomorrow that I put in today, you'll recognize it instantly, and that's all that matters. Well, okay, I'm glad to hear it. We'll make this a short session. You can spend the rest of today groping for the story the people of your culture have been enacting in the world for the past 10,000 years. Do you remember what it's about? About? It's about the meaning of the world, about divine intentions in the world, and about human destiny. Well, I can tell you stories about these things, but I don't know any one story. It's the one story that everyone in your culture knows and accepts. It's an explaining story, like how the elephant got its trunk or how the leopard got its spots. Okay. And what do you suppose it explains?
I have no idea.
I've already told you. It explains how things came to be this way, from the beginning until now.
I see, I said, and stared out of the window for a while. I'm certainly not aware of knowing such a story.
Ishmael pondered this for a minute or two. Do the people of your culture seem to you to be terribly distressed about the destruction you're inflicting on this planet?
No, for the most part, they're taking it pretty calmly.
One of my pupils explained their calmness this way. They're calm because they believe what they've been told.
I said, yes?
What have they been told that keeps them calm?
I don't know.
They've been told an explaining story. They've been given an explanation of how things came to be this way, and this stills their alarm. This explanation covers everything, including the deterioration of the ozone layer, the pollution of the oceans, the destruction of the rainforests, and even human extinction. And it satisfies them, or at least it pacifies them. They put their shoulders to the wheel during the day, stupefy themselves with drugs or television at night, and try not to think too searchingly about the world they're leaving their children to cope with.
Right.
You too have been told this story, this single story that explains how things came to be this way, though it apparently doesn't satisfy you as well as it satisfies most.
Well, I understand what you're saying, I said, but the fact remains that I don't know any such story, not any single story.
It's a single, perfectly unified story. Think mythologically.
What?
I'm talking about mythology, of course. Any story that explains the meaning of the world, the intentions of the gods, and the destiny of man is bound to be mythology.
Well, that may be so, but there's nothing like that in our culture, nothing that could be called mythology, unless you're talking about Greek mythology or Norse mythology.
I'm talking about living mythology, not recorded in any book, recorded in the minds of people and being enacted all over the world, even as we sit here and speak of it.
Again, there's nothing like that in our culture.
Ishmael's tarry forehead crinkled into furrows as he gave me a look of amused exasperation. This is because you think of mythology as a set of fanciful tales. I'm not talking about fanciful tales. I'm talking about ideas that shape your habits of thought and direct your lives from cradle to grave.
Okay.
Let's cut the assignment down to a more modest size. This story, like every story, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Before tomorrow, try to find the beginning of the story.
The beginning of the story?
Yes, think anthropologically.
I laughed. What does that mean?
If you were an anthropologist after this story being enacted by the Alawa Aborigines of Australia, you'd expect to hear a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Okay.
What would you expect the beginning of the story to be?
I have no idea.
Of course you do. You're just playing dumb.
I spent a minute trying to stop playing dumb.
Okay, I said. I guess I'd expect it to be their creation myth.
Of course.
But I don't see how that helps me.
Then I'll spell it out.
You are looking for your own culture's creation myth.
I stared at him balefully.
We have no creation myth, I said.
That's a certainty.
When I arrived the next morning, I found a tape recorder resting on the arm of my chair.
What's that for? I asked.
It's for recording for posterity the curious folk tales of a doomed culture which you are going to tell me.
I laughed and sat down. I'm afraid I haven't as yet found any curious folk tales to tell you.
No creation myth?
We have no creation myth, I said again. We have an account of creation, but it's certainly not a myth.
Tell it, then we'll know.
I sighed, turned on the recorder, and a few minutes later began. Steady state, or Big Bang, the universe started a long time ago, 10 or 15 billion years ago. And then, 6 or 7 billion years ago, our own solar system was born. Well, let's see. Life appeared in our ancient oceans about, what, 5 billion years ago?
3.5 or 4.
Okay. Bacteria, microorganisms evolved into higher forms, more complex forms, which evolved into still more complex forms. Life gradually spread to the land. I don't know, slimes at the edge of the oceans, amphibians. The amphibians moved inland, evolved into reptiles, and the reptiles evolved into mammals. That was, what, 1 billion years ago?
1/4 of 1 billion years ago.
Okay. Anyway, the mammals, I don't know, small critters in small niches under bushes in the trees. From the critters in the trees came the primates. Then, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 million years ago, one branch of the primates left the trees, and I ran out of steam.
The broad outlines will do, Ishmael said. Just the story as it's generally known, as it's known by bus drivers and ranch hands and senators.
Okay, I said. Well, one thing led to another. Species followed species, and finally man appeared. This was about 3 million years ago.
Is that it?
Well, that's it in outline. Ishmael nodded and told me to turn off the tape recorder. Then he sat back with a sigh and gave me a long, inscrutable look.
And you, an intelligent and moderately well-educated person, would have me believe that this isn't a myth?
Well, what's mythical about it? I didn't say there was anything mythical about it. I said it was a myth.
Well, maybe I don't know what you mean by a myth. I'm using the word in the ordinary sense.
Well, then it's not a myth.
Certainly it's a myth. Listen to it.
I rewound the tape, played it back, and said, well, it's not a myth. You could put that in an 8th grade science text, and no one would quibble with it, leaving aside the creationists.
I agree, he answered. As I said, the story is ambient in your culture. Children assemble it from many media, including textbooks.
Well, then what? Are you saying this isn't a factual account?
It's full of facts, but their arrangement is mythical.
I don't know what you mean.
You've obviously turned off your mind. Mother culture has crooned you to sleep.
Are you saying evolution's a myth?
No.
Well, then what is it?
You're not thinking, said Ishmael. You've recited a tale you heard 1,000 times, and now you're taking a nap. He watched me scowl a while and then said, all right, I'll tell you a story of my own, and maybe that'll help. This story takes place 500 million years ago, at a time when this planet would be unrecognizable to you. Nothing but wind and dust stirred on the land. Even the seas were eerily silent. But of course there was an anthropologist on hand. What sort of world would it be without an anthropologist? One day, as he walked by the ocean, he saw something bobbing in the waves offshore. It was just a squishy blob, but it was the only living thing he'd seen in all his journeys, so he waded out and greeted the creature politely. Soon they were good friends. He explained he was a student of lifestyles and customs, and begged his new friend for information of this sort, which was readily forthcoming. And now, he said at last, I'd like to get on tape some of the stories you tell among yourselves.
Stories, the other asked. You know, like your creation myth.
We have an account of creation, the other said, but it's definitely not a myth.
Oh, certainly not, the anthropologist said, remembering his training at last. I'd love to hear it.
So the creature agreed to tell its story.
The universe, it said, was born long ago, 10 or 15 billion years ago. Our own solar system appeared some 2 or 3 billion years ago. Then, after 1 billion years or so, life appeared on this planet. For millions of centuries, it was just microorganisms floating helplessly in a chemical broth. But little by little, more complex forms appeared. Single-celled creatures, slimes, algae, polyps, and so on. And finally,
the creature said, turning quite pink with pride as he came to the climax of his story, and finally jellyfish appeared. Nothing much came out of me for 90 seconds or so, except waves of baffled fury, and then I said, "You've made some sort of point, but I don't know what it is." "You don't?" Ishmael demanded. "The jellyfish's account of creation ends this way, and finally jellyfish appeared. What does that mean?"
"It means this was the final act of creation. There was no more to come. This is what it was all leading up to, the whole 10 or 15 billion years of creation. Jellyfish."
"Exactly. Your account of creation ends with very similar words, and finally man appeared. And what does that mean?"
"It means the same, that there was no more to come, that creation had come to an end, that this is what it was all leading up to."
"Of course, everyone in your culture knows this. The pinnacle was reached in man. Man is the climax of the whole cosmic drama of creation."
"Yes."
"When man appeared, creation came to an end. Its objective had been reached. There was nothing left to create."
"That's the unspoken assumption."
"It's not always unspoken. The religions of your culture aren't reticent about it. Man is the end product of creation. Man is the creature for whom all the rest was made. This world, this solar system, this galaxy, the universe itself."
"True.
But did the entire cosmic process of creation, in fact, come to an end 3 million years ago, right here on this little planet, with the appearance of man?"
"No, of course not."
"Then why did you tell it that way?"
"I guess because that's the way it's told."
"That's the way it's told among the takers. It's certainly not the only way it can be told."
"Yes, I can see that now.
So what are we to make of this story?"
I bared my teeth in a rueful grin.
"It's a myth. Incredibly enough, it's a myth."
Ishmael gazed at me.
"I said yesterday that your story is about the meaning of the world, divine intentions in the world, and human destiny. According to this first part, what's the meaning of the world?"
"According to this story, the meaning of the world is that it's the birthplace of man."
"Of course, the takers regard the world as a sort of human life support system, as a machine designed to produce and sustain human life."
"Yes, that's so."
"Supposing there is a divine agency behind creation, what does this story reveal about the gods' intentions?"
"Well, basically, the whole thing was for man. The gods created the universe so they could create us. If they hadn't wanted us, they wouldn't have bothered."
"Clearly," Ishmael said, "man must be a creature of enormous importance to the gods. But this part of the story doesn't reveal their intentions toward him. They must have some special destiny in mind for him, but it isn't revealed here."
"True.
Every story is based on a premise, is the working out of a premise. The story of the takers is the working out of this premise. The world was made for man."
I blinked over that for a moment and said, "I can't quite see why it's a premise."
"The people of your culture made it a premise, took it as a premise. They said, what if the world was made for us?"
"Keep going."
"Think of the consequences of taking that as your premise. If the world was made for you, then what?"
"Well, I see what you mean. If it was made for us, then it belongs to us, and we can do what we damn well please with it."
"Exactly. Every morning the people of your culture wake up and say to themselves, well, the world was made for us, so what shall we do with it today? That's what's been happening here for the past 10,000 years. You've been doing what you damn well please with the world."
"Yes," I said, and thought for a second. "Actually, that's pretty amazing. I mean, you hear this 50 times a day. People talk about our environment, our seas, our solar system. I've even heard people talk about our wildlife.
And just yesterday you assured me that there is nothing in your culture remotely resembling mythology."
"True, I did."
"Yesterday I said your story provides you with an explanation of how things came to be this way. What contribution does this first part of the story make to that explanation?"
Well, I guess it contributes this. Things came to be this way because the world was made for man. If it had been made for jellyfish, things would be different. So it's not our fault if the world is messed up. It's the gods' fault.
Ishmael smiled. You're beginning to get the idea.
Okay, I said when I arrived the next day, I think I have the middle and the end of the story down pat.
Ishmael nodded, and I started the tape recorder.
The world was made for man, I began, but it took him a long, long time to figure that out. For nearly 3 million years, he lived as though it had been made for jellyfish. He lived like a lion or a wombat.
What does that mean, to live like a lion or a wombat?
It means to live at the mercy of the world. It means to live without having any control over your environment.
I see. Go on.
Okay, in this condition, man could not be truly man. He couldn't develop a truly human way of life. So during the early part of his life, actually the greater part of his life, he just foozled along, getting nowhere and doing nothing. There was a key problem to be solved. Man couldn't get beyond a certain point living out in the open as a hunter-gatherer, always moving from place to place in search of food. He had to settle down, had to have a permanent base from which to build. Well, what stopped him from doing that? What stopped him was the fact that if he settled down in one place, he'd starve. As a hunter-gatherer, he'd simply clean the place out. There'd be nothing left to hunt and gather. To achieve settlement, man had to learn one fundamental manipulation. He had to manipulate his environment so that this food exhaustion didn't occur. He had to manipulate it so that it produced more human food. In other words, he had to become an agriculturalist. This was the turning point. The world had been made for man, but he couldn't take possession of it until this problem was solved, and he finally solved it 10,000 years ago, back there in the Fertile Crescent. This was a very big moment, the biggest in human history to this point. The limitations of the hunting-gathering life had kept man in check for 3 million years, but with agriculture, those limitations vanished. And his rise was meteoric. Settlement gave rise to division of labor. Division of labor gave rise to technology. With technology came trade and commerce. With trade and commerce came mathematics, literacy, science, and all the rest. The whole thing was underway at last. And the rest, as they say, is history. And that's the middle of the story.
Very impressive, Ishmael said. You realize that the big moment you've just described was the birth of your culture.
Yes.
Yesterday's part of the story revealed what the world means to the takers. It's a human life support system.
Right.
Today's part of the story is about the destiny of man. Clearly, it's not his destiny to live like a lion or a wombat. What is his destiny, then?
A man's destiny is to achieve, I answered, to accomplish great things, to build civilization.
You're thinking historically. We're looking for mythology. As we saw yesterday, creation wasn't complete when jellyfish appeared. According to your mythology, it was complete only when man appeared.
Right.
Why was it incomplete without man? Why did it need man?
I don't know.
Think about it. What was the world like without man?
Well, it was just a jungle.
You mean nature red in tooth and claw, dragons of the prime that tear each other in their slime?
That's it.
Without man, the world was unfinished, was just nature. It was in chaos, in a state of primeval anarchy. It needed what?
It needed someone to come in and straighten it out, someone to put it in order.
And what sort of person straightens things out? What sort of person takes anarchy in hand and puts it in order?
Well, a ruler, a king.
Of course, the world needed a ruler. It needed man. So now we have a clearer idea what this story is about. The world was made for man, and man was made to rule it.
Yes, that's very obvious now. Everyone understands that.
And this is what?
What?
Is this fact?
No, I said, it's mythology.
Ishmael shifted position and went on. You say it took man a long time to realize he was meant for greater things than could be achieved living like a lion or a wombat. For 3 million years, he was just one more creature rolling in the slime. Right. He only realized about 10,000 years